your next great vacation might be something you've never even considered. A private yacht in a beautiful location just for you and your closest friends and family. Explore the beaches of the Virgin Islands, the ancient shores of Greece, or the tropical paradise of Tahiti. This is not a cruise. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings. And it's easier than you think. With hundreds of award-winning yachts to choose from, located in over 20 beautiful sailing destinations, the world is in your hands. Whether you're an experienced boater or looking for a more genuine once-in-a-lifetime vacation, The Moorings can make your dream a reality. Call us today and start your journey to your next great escape. Your private yacht awaits at moorings.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 3 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Garibaldi at Palermo. The reconstruction of his army. The advance through the island. Addio, mia belle, addio. La morte se ne va. Se non partissi anch'io, sarebbe una viltà. Farewell, farewell, my true love. The army's on the move, and if I stayed with you, love, a coward I should prove. The three steamers which were to carry Medici and his men to Sicily had been purchased from a French company, nominally on behalf of de Rohan, a Yankee devotee of the Italian cause. They had been hastily rechristened the Washington, Oregon, and Franklin, and the United States consul at Genoa, accompanied by Garibaldi's Englishman, Paird, who was starting with the expedition, went on board the Washington and hauled upon it the Stars and Stripes. A little before dawn on June 10th, Medici sailed with the Washington and Oregon from a spot a few miles west of Genoa, where a midnight embarkation had taken place, and on the same day the Franklin sailed from the shore between Pisa and Leghorn, where she had taken on board the Tuscan Volunteers. These two parts of Medici's expedition met safely at Calgary, the port in southern Sardinia, which became henceforth an important place of call for successive shiploads of Garibaldini. But two other vessels, the small Utile and the American clipper Charles and Jane, which were also expected at Calgary with another 1,000 men, were captured on the way by Neapolitan cruisers and taken into the harbor of Gaeta. Medici, after waiting for them for some time in vain, left Calgary with the Washington, Oregon, and Franklin, containing 2,500 men, 6,000 or 8,000 rifles and muskets, and an immense store of ammunition. This was the first aid dispatched to Garibaldi from the mainland. With the exception of 60 men and a stock of arms and powder, which the Utile, since captured by the Neapolitans, had run through to Palermo by way of Marsala on an earlier and more fortunate voyage. Medici's three vessels left Calgary early on the afternoon of June 16th, shortly before nightfall of the following day, when they were nearing the Sicilian coast and entering the zone of greatest danger from the Neapolitan cruisers. They saw a Piedmontese war vessel steering towards them. When she came alongside, she turned out to be the Gulnara, whose commander came aboard the Washington to speak with Medici. He had orders from his admiral, Persano, to conduct the expedition safely to Castellamare, the landing place agreed on between Persano and Garibaldi. The commander of the Gulnara also made in Persano's name a strange request for the instant surrender of Mazzini. Medici was able to assure him that, although the Republican Alberto Mario and his English wife, Jessie White Mario, were on board, Mazzini himself had not accompanied the expedition. A few hours later they reached Castellamare and began to disembark before midnight. Garibaldi came to meet them, and they marched in high spirits to Palermo, arriving there on the 19th, and the two following days, just as the last of the Neapolitan garrison took their departure under the terms of the capitulation. The new era in Garibaldi's enterprise had now fairly begun. The demand made by the commander of the Gulnara for the surrender of Mazzini out at sea was the end of a curious story. Cavour, who after the fall of Palermo had adopted the policy of aiding Garibaldi, upon terms instructed Admiral Persano to lend him what covert help he could, but at the same time sent out a confidential agent of his own to represent to the dictator of Sicily the wishes of the government of Turin. Cavour's choice for this purpose had fallen on the Sicilian, La Farina, president of the National Society, who, like Bertani, had done much to bring Cavour and Garibaldi together in old days, and like Bertani seemed now to aim at undoing his own work. He was already an object of dislike in Garibaldian circles when Cavour unwisely chose him for this delicate task. Those of Cavour's friends who knew Garibaldi foresaw inevitable disaster. La Farina arrived in Palermo during the first week of June and began almost at once to quarrel with the new masters of the city. He turned his reports to Cavour into a series of bitter attacks on the dictator and his administration, some just and some unjust, but all calculated to alienate the two men on whose alliance the welfare of Italy depended. On June 12th, Cavour, misinformed by his spies at Genoa as to Mazzini's movements, sent the following message to Admiral Persano. "We are assured that Mazzini and Mrs. White, Jesse Mario, have embarked on board the Washington that is taking volunteers to Palermo. Send La Farina to Garibaldi to invite him in the King's name to arrest Mazzini and to give him into your hands. He must tell him that Mazzini's presence in Sicily would necessitate the recall of the squadron and ruin the national cause in Europe. You will send Mazzini to Genoa on board the Carlo Alberto. Should Garibaldi refuse to have Mazzini arrested, you will immediately prepare to depart with the fleet and will send the Othion to Calgary to receive instructions." This letter proves that there were limits to Cavour's understanding of Garibaldi, though it was large compared with Garibaldi's understanding of Cavour. It was an error to expect Garibaldi to hand over to prison his former master and honored rival, now in the decline of years and prosperity, and a folly to enforce the demand by a threat to the liberator of Palermo in his hour of triumph. Cavour had never had the chance of studying Garibaldi and his friends at close quarters. Otherwise, he would have known that Garibaldi himself was above all things a gentleman, and that Mazzini was regarded by the whole world of exiles and advanced patriots, even when they most differed from him, with a reverence which to Cavour was foolishness. La Farina flatly refused to carry out the mission, saying that he had no influence with the dictator, and compelled the admiral to take the message himself. Persano, who was at this time popular with all parties, was not ordered out of the room as La Farina would probably have been, but Garibaldi replied that he would not arrest Mazzini unless he began to intrigue against the monarchy of Victor Emmanuel. Persano, fully realizing Cavour's mistake in tactics, determined instead of making preparations to leave Palermo to effect the arrest of Mazzini before he landed in Sicily. That was why he commissioned the commander of the Gulnara when he went to meet Medici to make the arrest out at sea. But since Mazzini was all the while in Genoa, the incident ended in a fiasco. The main object of La Farina's mission to Sicily was to secure the immediate annexation of the island to Piedmont. Cavour was unwilling to allow Garibaldi, by prolonging his dictatorship, to acquire a civil and military establishment of his own, independent of the royal government. It was necessary to send out arms and men to Garibaldi, but it was impossible not to dread some of the uses to which he might turn those arms and his own immense popularity. Surrounded as he was in great measure by the friends of Mazzini and Bertani, by the Marios, by Crispi, by Nicotera, it was probable that, while continuing loyal as ever to the monarchy, he might grow less and less amenable to the advice of the king's ministers. Cavour was struggling to keep his feet in a flood of diplomatic troubles, which Garibaldi thought it unpatriotic even to consider. And yet the dictator's independent actions were the prime factor in the diplomatic situation of which he ignored the very existence. There were also grave political dangers of an internal character in a prolonged dictatorship. Cavour was endeavoring to build up the unity of Italy on the only possible basis, that of a constitutional monarchy, and if the advanced parties were to get all the credit of the revolution in South Italy and enjoy an infinite tenure of power in the provinces which they liberated, it would be a bad beginning for the principle of authority in the new state as represented by the king's parliamentary cabinet at Turin. Therefore Cavour desired as soon as possible to dominate the revolution, and like the falconer to lure his hawk back after it had struck the prey. These motives, and these principles of action, were sound in themselves, but there remains always the question of particular application. If indeed the enemies of Italy had already been struck down by Garibaldi, or if Cavour had been prepared to strike them down himself in open war, then no date would have been too early for annexation of Sicily. But the House of Bourbon still reigned on the mainland, and could be overturned by Garibaldi alone. When Cavour attempted to obtain the annexation of Sicily in June and early July, he was acting on the mistaken belief that an annexationist revolution could be engineered by his own agents in Naples. He imagined that the rank and file of the Neapolitan army was prepared to come over to the Italian cause, and that a civil and military pronunciamento would speedily bring the Bourbon dynasty to an end by the act of the Neapolitans themselves. If such a revolution had been possible, it would no doubt have been safer to dispense with Garibaldi's further service as an independent chieftain, and to bring him back to the place which he had occupied in the war of 1859, as the leader of volunteers fighting in front of the royal armies of Italy, whenever they should next be led against Pope or Austrian. But Cavour had yet to learn by experience that Neapolitans would effect no revolution for themselves, and that as he was not himself prepared to declare war on Francis II, Garibaldi must be allowed to cross the Straits of Messina, if Italy was to be free. If in June the dictator had yielded to the cry for immediate annexation, which La Farina stirred up among the Sicilians, the island would have passed officially into the hands of Piedmont, and before Garibaldi had marched onward from Palermo, Victor Emmanuel would have found himself completely responsible to the powers for every act of every red shirt in Sicily. In that case, Garibaldi, who even as it was came very near to being stopped at the Straits of Messina by the powers, would almost certainly have been prevented from crossing to the mainland, since Cavour could no longer have pleaded inability to control his action. Then, when the Neapolitan Revolution had misfired, the great statesman would have discovered too late the flaw in his plans, and the Pope and the King of Naples would have continued to govern central and southern Italy. All this was clearly foreseen at the time by not a few Cavourians, including Michele Amari, the wise and learned historian of the Sicilian Vespers, who was just returning from exile to his own Palermo to work there for Italian unity. Amari was certain that the dictator did right to refuse annexation in June, because annexation would have confined him to the island, but he was equally certain that he was wrong to refuse annexation when once he had crossed the straits. For nearly a month, La Farina laid siege to Garibaldi. At his instigation, petitions were sent up by Sicilian ministers and municipalities, and demonstrations were held in the streets of Palermo, which showed a genuine popular desire for immediate annexation. The attitude of the islanders was neither that of Cavour nor that of Garibaldi. They desired annexation at the earliest possible moment, because they saw in it the best security against reconquest by the Neapolitans and the quickest way to a settled government. They cried, "Italia una," with no feigned zeal when they saw their protectors, the red shirts, and hope for the Bersaglieri to follow, as adverters of Bourbon reconquest, but they cared little whether the hated Neapolitans were or were not brought into the Union, and only the more enlightened individuals among them strongly supported Garibaldi's project of crossing the Straits. But while, from these selfish motives, they favored Cavour's plan of immediate annexation, on the other hand, their devotion to Garibaldi, who had come to their rescue like a paladin of old, was so powerful a compound of superstition with pure human gratitude and love that no difference of political opinion could wear it away. As late as the middle of September, when Garibaldi was clearly wrong in delaying the annexation any longer, he had only to come to show himself in Palermo, and although he was standing in the way of the popular desire, all opposition was silenced in heartfelt shouts of welcome and applause. When, therefore, in June, La Farina represented the island to Cavour as being already on the point of a terrible explosion of popular wrath against the dictatorship, he was writing nonsense such as only an angry man can write. Garibaldi said in effect to the people of Palermo and to his Sicilian ministers, "I know you desire to vote the annexation at once, but I desire to free the rest of Italy first. I have freed you, and in return I ask you to wait while I free your brothers. Fight first and vote afterwards." They consented to wait, less for the sake of their brothers than for the sake of the man who asked them this slight return for all that he and his thousand had done. La Farina, in his letters to Cavour, not only represented the Sicilians as more hostile to Garibaldi than they really were, but he also represented the island as falling into a state of anarchy, whereas, in fact, the disturbance was merely such as war and revolution must necessarily bring in their train among a population accustomed to self-government. Bitter personal animosity to Crispi, Garibaldi's factotum in the island, goaded on La Farina to these exaggerations. The two Sicilians were deadly rivals for the affections of their countrymen. La Farina was so far right that Garibaldi was utterly unfitted to cope with any purely political or administrative situation, or to bring order out of the chaos of revolution. But the chaos was not of the kind which destroys society. La Farina was right in saying that annexation was desirable at the earliest date possible in the interests of administration in Sicily. And as Amari pointed out, the gendarmerie of North Italy were the only force capable of restoring complete order in the island. Yet Sicily continued under the Garibaldian rule for nearly 6 months without any positive catastrophe. Nor when Victor Emmanuel's government took over the administration did the Cavourians find it an easy task. For 10 years the island was in a continual state of unrest. The hermit of Caprera was the last man likely to succeed as administrator or politician. Beyond the life of the sailor, the poet, the farmer, and the soldier in active service, he understood nothing of the ways of men. His friend and biographer has justly said, "Finance, police, taxation, law courts, bureaucratic machinery were to him artificial and oppressive additions to the life of nature, invented by the wickedness or craft of man. If he could, he would have swept them all away. As he could not, he resigned himself to submit to them, but in his heart despised and abhorred them." Now for one holding these ideas, it is not easy to govern states well, or even to choose the best men to govern them. And so it was with Garibaldi. One thing he saw with unerring vision during his dictatorship, from his landing at Marsala till his arrival in Naples, and that was that he must put off the annexation of the kingdom to the monarchy of Victor Emmanuel until the revolution, which was to lay the foundation of Italian unity, had become an accomplished fact. Garibaldi endured La Farina for a month, and then his patience gave way. He had always held high ideas of the dictatorial power in times of crisis, when the freedom of the country was at stake. He was determined to advance on Naples and make Italy, and if Cavour's agents strove to lock him up in Sicily by arousing there a movement for premature annexation, the man must take the consequences. He decided to send him back to his master. On July 7th, La Farina's house was surrounded by the police. He was made prisoner, taken on board the Piedmontese flagship, and handed over to Admiral Persano, from whom La Farina's captors had the impudence to demand a receipt for his person. Nor was this all. A notice of his expulsion from the island was inserted in the official paper of Sicily in terms of malignant insult. La Farina was spoken of as expelled with two other men, Gricelli and Totti. The three men thus deported, said the official journal, were in Palermo conspiring against the existing order of things. Now Gricelli and Totti were two of the meanest of mankind, who had narrowly escaped execution on a charge of plotting to assassinate the dictator, and La Farina had no more to do with them than he had with the beggars on the steps of the cathedral. For the decision to deport La Farina, there was much to be said. It restored political peace at Palermo, and cut short a controversy which could not safely be conducted in the face of the enemy, who still had 20,000 troops in the island. But the manner of his deportation was most offensive, and leaves a stain on the chivalrous character of Garibaldi. It is not known whether the details were planned by him or by some ill-natured follower, but it is certain that he never punished or reproved the gross insult offered to the emissary of the royal government. The expulsion of La Farina from Sicily, and still more the manner of the expulsion, embittered the quarrel of Cavourian and Garibaldian throughout the Italian world. But the nation as a whole, with a political instinct inspired by the supreme nature of the crisis, continued to regard Cavour and Garibaldi as partners in the great work. The dictator had now cut the knot of Sicilian politics and was free to advance across the straits if he had the military strength. Indirectly, he had done Cavour a service, of which the latter was quick to take advantage. The incident could be used as a proof to diplomatic Europe that the royal government had no control over the dictator's actions. Cavour, wrote Hudson to Lord John Russell, says that the government have no influence with Garibaldi, who has ordered La Farina to quit Sicily. In spite of La Farina and the vexed question of immediate annexation, June and July were full of happy days for Garibaldi, for the Sicilians, and for the volunteers who came pouring in by every steamer from the north. All classes of the population of Palermo, with priests and monks conspicuous among them, trooped down to the harbour to work at dismantling the Castelmare, the fortress whence the Bourbons had so long held Palermo in awe. The church in Sicily lost none of its enthusiasm for Garibaldi on nearer view. The archbishop was friendly, and even consented to bless the troops. The nunneries of Palermo, where almost every noble family had a daughter shut up for life, the enthusiasm for Giuseppe and his young followers who had, in several cases during the street fighting, saved them from the brutality of the Neapolitan soldiers, was shown in many pretty and pathetic ways. Garibaldi, writing to Ruggiero Settimo, the veteran statesman of Sicily's former revolutions, described the feelings which he shared so fully with the people. "This brave people is free. Joy is written on every face. The country echoes with the glad cries of the liberated." Garibaldi had good reason to be happy. He was fulfilling by his own methods and with his own followers the dream of his life, which had seemed foolishness to the wise. The vision of all that he might some day do for Italy had first risen before his mind's eye more than 20 years before, as he rode over the Pampas, leading a few dozen partisans to nameless skirmishes in long-forgotten wars. The vision had drawn near, only to vanish again like a mirage on the walls of Rome. Dim with fears of failure, it had yet given him strength to endure the marshes of Ravenna and in the trading vessels on the faraway Pacific. It had cheered his farm life at Caprera with a steadier glow of hope, And now all Europe was watching this poet's daydream enact itself in the world of living men. Bixio and many other volunteers, officers, and privates, wounded and whole, lodged in the Trinacria, the famous hotel looking out upon the Esplanade. Its host, Ragusa, a worthy Piedmontese, announced that for 30 days he would dine any of the thousand for nothing. But next year he told an English guest that there had not been a man of them but had insisted upon paying his bill. The dictator and his aides-de-camp lived at the other end of town, in the so-called observatory of the palace over Porta Nuova. It had two balconies, one looking eastward down the mile-long Toledo to the sea, the other westward across the Concha de Oro to the mountains above Monreal. Its interior consisted of a modest hall of audience with the beds of the four officers on duty concealed behind screens in the four corners, and two little bedrooms beyond for Garibaldi and his secretary. The manners and way of life of the dictator in the palace at Palermo, as afterwards in Naples and Caserta, were in no way different from those on his Caprera farm. Formality there was none. Important visitors were sent to him to have an audience, whatever he was doing. Not infrequently they found him combing out his hair, to which he still gave long and careful attention, although the thick flowing locks which had adorned the defender of Rome no longer fell over his shoulders. On another occasion, with more dispatch, he evacuated his red shirt and grey flannels and retired into bed, still discussing the business in hand with his astonished visitor. The terrace roof, connecting the observatory, where the general lived, with the main part of the palace, was a rendezvous in the summer evenings for the principal Garibaldini, for the ladies of Palermo, and for the officers of the Piedmontese and British navies. Eager questionings and endless stories about the battles and adventures which had led them thither so far were mingled with confident prophecies of the coming campaign. All agreed that they would enter both Rome and Venice before the winter. The perfumes rising from the gardens of the plain, the sun setting behind the distant mountains where the thousand had suffered and fought, the place, the time, the events produced a sort of delicious ecstasy which annihilated distances and transfigured facts. Nor was this a mere effect of the southern temperature, for English officers shared those emotions, those illusions, those errors of enthusiasm. Among this happy crowd on the terrace appeared one evening, like death at the feast, a group of young men, prematurely aged and bent, looking about them with eyes that seemed to gaze without seeing. They were the remaining 8 followers of Pisacani, who had started with him 3 years before from Genoa on his rash attempt to overthrow the Bourbon power. Since their defeat and the death of their leader and companions, they had lain in the dungeons of the island of Favignana, whence only 6 weeks ago they had seen through the prison bars the Piemont and Lombardo sail past with the thousand to Marsala. The revolution had now reached Favignana and set them free, and they had come straight to Palermo to demand places in the forefront of Garibaldi's battles. The first person whom they met on the terrace was the long-bearded Antonio Mosto, leader of the Genoese Carabineers. As soon as he had recognized his friends beneath the changes that misery had wrought in them, he granted them the privilege, sought by many in vain, of enlisting as privates in his little company that fought in the van of the army, and bore the highest proportion of the losses. They were taken into the observatory to see the general. He was deeply moved. "This," he said, "is a type of human life. We, whom fortune favored with victory, lodge in royal places. These brave fellows, because conquered, are buried in the vaults of Favignana. Yet the cause, the undertaking, the audacity was the same. The first honors are due to Pisacani. He led the way, and these brave fellows were our pioneers." Their leader, Nicotera, who had been Pisacani's lieutenant, was sent to organize the new expedition of volunteers preparing in Tuscany, where his incorrigible republicanism soon caused trouble. The others marched with Garibaldi, and a few weeks later 5 out of the 7 fell dead or wounded on the field of Milazzo. But the terrace and observatory were sometimes besieged by less disinterested visitors. Even before the capture of Palermo was complete, even before the Bourbon troops had signed the capitulation, no less than 3,000 petitions for employment had been sent in, each petitioner setting forth his own claims on the state in terms of fulsome panegyric. If Garibaldi had placed northerners in the governorships and magistracies, these duties might have been more effectively fulfilled. But in so disposing of patronage, he would have alienated the Sicilians. This must be remembered by those who criticize the undoubted maladministration under the dictatorship. Many of the better sort of Sicilians, especially the returning exiles, retired into private life, disdaining to advance their real claims on the state. But the worst class of petitioners set upon him like yelping hounds. He was utterly unfitted to choose among the pack. "The dictator says yes to everyone, and leaves me to disentangle matters," complained Nievo, the poet of the thousand, now vice-intendant of the national forces in Sicily. "Everyone makes court to me," he wrote in disgust. "Princes, princesses, dukes, duchesses by the shovelfuls, coveting salaries of 20 ducats a month." On the civil side, Crispi made selection among his fellow islanders for better, for worse. Garibaldi's only way of dealing with this foul, levantine disease of state sycophancy was to apply the ineffectual remedy of his own example. The dictator took 10 francs a day for his civil list, and did not add to it by any indirect means. Once when he burnt a hole in his clothes, he was hard put to it for a change. To Alexandra Dumas, who had come over in his yacht to see historical romance in the living reality, Garibaldi said one day, "If I were rich, I would do like you. I would have a yacht." Dumas was much moved, for he had just seen him sign a check for 500,000 francs of public money. It was fortunate for Garibaldi that North Italy was so generous with the purse, and that by one of his unusual pieces of luck he had captured from the Neapolitan government an immense sum of ready money, which had been called in for recoinage and lay in the mint at Palermo. For by the middle of July the Sicilians had subscribed voluntarily no more than 5,000 lire. The British consul, who had seen them win and lose their freedom in 1848 and 1849, observed the same characteristics once more. Passion wreaked on the statues of the Bourbons and the stones of the Castellamare, flags, shoutings, bombastic processions, but no foresight, no fruitful fear of reconquest, no general and public self-sacrifice. Since on this occasion they had North Italy to protect them, their sense of security was less ill-founded. But Garibaldi's edict of conscription remained a dead letter, and he was soon induced by deputations from the upland communes to suspend it until the agricultural work of the year was over, that is, until the Greek calends. Most of the squadre, or irregular bands of peasants, went back to their homes before or after the capitulation of Palermo. But several thousands of Sicilians, volunteering for more regular service, were formed into regiments and drilled by native, by North Italian, and by English officers. They proved far more efficient than the squadre, and although the degrees of courage which they displayed in the coming campaign varied from time to time, on the whole they did credit, both in their own island and on the mainland, to the officers who had in a few weeks knocked them into soldiers. Some of the upper class of the island behaved poorly, refusing to serve unless they were at once given commissions, although scores of the noble and wealthy families of North Italy had sons doing the meanest duties of the camp, and thinking a red shirt better wear than epaulets. There were, indeed, many of the Sicilian upper class who did their duty well, but the island regiments consisted of the lower orders of the population to a greater degree than did the regiments from the north. Dunne's English regiment, in particular, was largely recruited from the corner boys of Palermo, who under discipline and good influences behaved with marked courage in Milazzo fight. Many of these lads had passed a fortnight or 3 weeks in the Garibaldi Foundling Hospital, established and conducted on excellent military lines by Alberto Mario. Happy as they were in this institution, they deserted from it fast to join Dunne's regiment, because they were told that under Milordo they would go sooner to the wars with Garibaldi. Milordo himself was one of the most romantic figures in the Garibaldian camp. Dunne had a share of the mysterious power of Nicholson or Gordon to inspire confidence, discipline, and courage into untrained races. He had commanded Turkish levies for the British government in the Crimea. Shortly before the capture of Palermo, he accepted, at Hudson's suggestion, a dangerous mission from Cavour and La Farina to carry a political message through to Garibaldi and to smuggle into Sicily the Cavourian agent Scelzi, disguised as his servant. Scelzi and Dunne had landed in North Sicily, raised several hundred squadre of their own account, skirmished with the Bourbon troops, and entered Palermo at the head of their men a few days before the capitulation was signed. Dunne then discarded his squadre and set to work to make a real regiment out of apparently unpromising material. Aided by Windham, an Englishman, formerly of the Austrian army, by a dozen civilians just come from Great Britain and Ireland for love of Garibaldi, and some ex-sergeants of the Piedmontese army, he soon manufactured a force of 600 young Sicilians whom the dictator could have ill spared in the coming battle. Whatever his political errors, Garibaldi had a firm hold of the military situation and did not waste a day. On June 20th, 24 hours after the departure of the last Neapolitan troops, and while Medici's men were still arriving in Palermo, a column under Tour started for the center of the island with orders to march by way of Caltanissetta to Catania on the eastern sea. The force, when it left the capital, numbered little more than 500 men, consisting chiefly of members of the original 1,000, together with a small company of foreign deserters from the Bourbon army, and a dozen Sicilian gentlemen. This brigade, as it was called, was the more formidable in report because of 2 obsolete cannon retrieved from the ignominious position of posts in the streets of Palermo, remounted and dragged across the island as artillery. The foreign company had good Enfield rifles, but the majority of the force, the remnant of the 1,000, still had their old bad muskets. Ammunition was procured on the way in the sulfur district of Caltanissetta. Being the first column to leave Palermo for the front, Tudor's brigade created great interest. It was accompanied by some of the best war correspondents in Europe, and by Alexandra Dumas with a female midshipman in tow. The vain, good-natured, luxurious giant, liked by some, disliked by others, and laughed at by all of his companions on the march, left them halfway and returned to headquarters at Palermo. The expedition, though romantic and picturesque, was uneventful. At Mislemeri, the population, which had shown fierce enthusiasm and sent its squadre for the attack on Palermo when Garibaldi passed that way 3 weeks before, was found to be sullenly hostile because of the edict of conscription. When they learnt that it was to be inoperative, they recovered their cheerfulness and enjoyed the eloquence of Garibaldi's friar, Father Pantaleo, which produced 2 volunteer recruits. Here Tour fell dangerously ill and was forced to return to the continent for a few weeks to recover his health. The command of the column devolved on his fellow Hungarian Eber, who did not on that account give over his functions as Times correspondent. Eber was a reserved and quiet gentleman, known and respected in the English Lake District, where he had passed many years of exile, and in the best London society. He had neither Tour's military experience and vigor, nor his popularity with the troops. but he had an easy part to play and fell into no capital errors. Passing through the heart of the island by Ena and the rock citadel of Castro Giovanni, which commands the finest view in Sicily, Eber and his men skirted Etna on the south and entered Catania unopposed on July 15th. After Misselmeri, they had been well received, in most places with real enthusiasm, and they had put down some incipient brigandage. But they did not pick up many recruits in the course of their march from sea to sea. On June 25th, less than a week after the departure of Tours and Eber's column, Bixio left the capital with another brigade of about 1,200 men, consisting partly of Sicilians and partly of northerners under Caldesi, who had come out in Medici's expedition. Passing through Piana di Greci, where he enlisted 60 of the warlike Albanians, through Corleone and by the temples of Gergenti, Bixio reached the southern coast, sailed along it from Licata to Terranova, and marched thence straight across the country to Catania, where he joined Eber's column in the latter half of July. Meanwhile, as will be recounted in the next chapter, Medici, with a far better organized, better armed, and better disciplined force, was moving along the north coast towards Milazzo. This northern detachment could be most quickly supported by Garibaldi himself with the reserves which he was busily forming in Palermo. The columns of Eber in the center and of Bixio in the south were to a large extent stage armies, not therefore the less effective in paralyzing the Bourbon generals at Messina. Garibaldi justly relied on the inactivity of those veteran warriors, or else he would not have sent two weak columns to roam at large through the island and finally unite at Catania, not far from Messina, where lay 15,000 to 20,000 Bourbon troops. Judged by the rules of ordinary war, the division of the dictator's slender forces into three appears an absurd error, but under the actual conditions he was justified in making the division, because, while the force with which he intended to strike home on the north coast was immensely the strongest and proved sufficient for its purpose, the other two flying columns served to alarm the Bourbon generals and to render them less willing to advance from Messina and attack his real force in front of Milazzo with the requisite vigor. But the chief purpose of the columns of Eber and Bixio was not military, but political. They established the authority of the dictator in three quarters of the island. They nipped in the bud the beginning of anarchy and brigandage. They obtained several thousand recruits, mostly after their arrival on the east coast, and they set up before Europe the claim of Garibaldi to the real possession of the island. But that claim had still to be made good in the Battle of Milazzo. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Battle of Milazzo. Who is the happy warrior? Who is he whom every man in arms should wish to be? It is the generous spirit who, when brought among the tasks of real life, hath wrought upon the plan that pleased his childish thought, whose high endeavors are an inward light that make the path before him always bright, whose powers shed round him in the common strife, or mild concerns of ordinary life, a constant influence, a peculiar grace, but who, if he be called upon to face some awful moment to which heaven has joined great issues, good or bad, for humankind, is happy as a lover, and attired with sudden brightness like a man inspired, and through the heat of conflict keeps the law in calmness made, and sees what he foresaw. Wordsworth. By June 19th, Palermo and most of the other garrison towns in Sicily had been completely evacuated, but there still remained 18,000 effective Bourbon troops in Messina, 2,000 in Syracuse, over 1,000 in Milazzo, and 500 in Augusta. On the mainland there were some 80,000 more, of whom large numbers could be shipped to the island from Naples in a few hours. In these circumstances, two rational courses were open to the Royalists. Either a vigorous counterattack might be made, first on the columns which Garibaldi was sending out from Palermo, and then upon that city itself. Before the 3,000 North Italian volunteers had grown to 10, 15, and 20,000. Or else the opposite course might be chosen. A course less ambitious, indeed, but more consistent with the grant of the Constitution and the new diplomatic attitude adopted towards France, England, and Piedmont. Sicily might be written off as lost, and the troops in it confined to garrison work within the sea fortress of Messina, Syracuse, Milazzo, and Augusta. These places, if supplied and assisted by the fleet, could not be taken by the means at Garibaldi's disposal. Further fighting would thus be avoided in the island, and a claim would thereby be established on the good offices of England and France. The sea powers, pleased at such moderation in the court of Naples, might not improbably use their fleets to stop Garibaldi at the Straits of Messina. With or without such aid, the military defense of the new constitutional kingdom could be reorganized on the Calabrian shore of the Straits, with the citadel of Messina as hostage, effectively held on the enemy's ground. If logically executed, either the offensive or the defensive plan had a good chance of success. But since they were mutually inconsistent, a clear choice had to be made between the two systems. Any compromise between them might easily lead to disaster. The offensive system was favored by General Clary, in command at Messina, and by most of his subordinate officers, by the king at Naples, and by those of his advisers who were still reactionary at heart. But the new liberal minister, and above all the new war minister, General Pianell, wished to suspend operations in Sicily and organize a diplomatic and military defense behind the straits. The ministers had good reason to depreciate further hostilities, for while a victory of Garibaldi would overthrow the dynasty, a defeat of Garibaldi would overthrow the constitution, and their own position depended on the maintenance of dynasty and constitution together. While the ministers remained inactive and sought the ways of peace, neither the king at Naples nor the general at Messina had the nerve to wage a vigorous offensive war in their despite. But the reactionary party was not entirely without influence on events in June and July. It had sufficient power in court and camp to sow distrust between the ministers and the crown, and to initiate in Sicily a feeble and partial offensive movement under Colonel Bosco, of which Garibaldi took advantage to escape the danger of an armistice, to win the Battle of Milazzo, and thereby to create the panic among the Bourbon troops on the Straits, which enabled him to march almost unresisted to Naples. Such, in brief, is the significance of the events narrated in this chapter. General Clary had distinguished himself on May 31st in suppressing an attempt of some local squadre to occupy Catania, when immediately after his little victory he was ordered to abandon Catania and retire to headquarters at Messina. He obeyed under protest. As one of the very few generals who had shown any spirit during the operations in May, Clary was in June promoted marshal and placed in command of the royal forces at Messina. A strong reactionary, he at once drew up schemes for the reconquest first of Catania and then of Palermo, and applied to Naples for approval. On June 25th, King Francis sent him orders to take the offensive in accordance with his own proposals. But the new marshal, on whose brave words the reactionaries had for some weeks been building their hopes, proved after all to be much of the same caliber as the other generals. For soon as he was ordered to advance, the tone of Clary's reports changed wonderfully. He began to write of the unfitness and unwillingness of his troops, of the necessity of remaining on the defensive, of the probability that if he left Messina with a part of his force, Garibaldi would slip in behind his back, and as he slipped into Palermo behind the back of Von Michel. But again, as soon as the ministry countermanded the advance and bade him remain on the defensive, Clary recovered his courage and complained bitterly that such orders dampened the spirits of his men. Meanwhile, King Francis was consulting his generals and ministers at Naples on a proposal to send strong reinforcements from the mainland to reconquer Sicily. In a council held on July 13th, the ministers opposed it, giving their voices in favor of armistice and diplomatic action, and their arguments were supported by Generals Nunziante and Pianell, the two best soldiers in the service since Filangieri's retirement. The plan was therefore abandoned, and the next day Pianell, in an evil hour for his own reputation and peace of mind, was induced to become Minister of War. An honest, cultivated, and high-minded man, true to the dynasty and to the constitution, he failed to see that the one could now be saved only at the expense of the other. He was fully persuaded that Sicily could not be reconquered. Perhaps he did not dare to ask himself whether he wished it to be reconquered. He maintained that the island had been lost because of the demoralized condition of the army, and that it would be his chief duty as war minister, while passively defending the straits, to revive the discipline and military spirit of the royal forces. A critic might have urged that the only way to revive their spirit would be to discard tricolor and constitution and bid them march forward under the white flag of the Bourbons, with the king in their midst, as was afterwards done with some success at Capua, a few months too late. No troops could feel enthusiasm for the Constitution and at the same time fight loyally against the man who was the cause of the Constitution's existence. But whatever Pianell's plan was worth, it never had a fair trial, for on July 14th, Marshal Clary sent Colonel Bosco with 3,000 picked troops along the north coast from Messina, with orders to occupy the open country between Milazzo and Barcelona. This half-hearted measure, taken out of the knowledge of Pianell, had all the faults and none of the merits of the defensive plan decreed by the ministers, and of the offensive desired by the king. Bosco was the fighting man of the army, and the news that he had been sent into the open field with a force of his own was regarded by everyone as a bid for the reconquest of Sicily. Yet the actual orders given by Clary to the colonel on the day before he left Messina reflect the divided councils of the royalist camp. In this document, Bosco is reminded that the ministry has forbidden any fresh attack to be made. He must therefore leave it to the enemy to begin the fighting. But when attacked himself, he has the right to make a counterattack and dislodge the Garibaldini from their positions. The object of the expedition is defined as being to guard the threatened garrison of Milazzo from a blockade, though in fact this end could have been far more simply effected by the use of the fleet. For this purpose, Clary advises Bosco to occupy Arci and certain other places some miles out of Milazzo. He is not to proceed farther westward than Barcelona, even if victorious, but is to await orders there. These instructions, which might be interpreted in many different ways, when thus placed in the hands of a spirited officer, were certain to lead to a pitched battle, for when Bosco left Messina, Medici, in command of 2,000 Garibaldini, had already for a week made Barcelona his headquarters, and had been scouting with his friends on the mountains that tower above the plain of Milazzo. Giacomo Medici, who had held the Vacello for 4 weeks against the French army on the Janiculum, was the friendly rival of Bixio for the first place among Garibaldi's lieutenants. To him, the general had entrusted the leadership of the most important of the three columns now advancing through the island on Messina, that one which was to keep the north coast and be supported in case of need by Garibaldi himself and the reserves from Palermo. Medici left the capital with 1,800 of the well-armed volunteers whom he had brought from North Italy, Simonetta's Lombards and Malicini's Tuscans. The general's orders were that he should occupy Castel Real, a strong position in the mountains above Barcelona, and there await orders. but when he found the coast towns enthusiastic in the national cause, when he was joined by several hundred local volunteers and bands from eastern Sicily, he felt unwilling to retire into the mountains on Bosco's approach, leaving his hosts at Barcelona to the Bourbon vengeance. Such a retreat would inflict a wound on the growing prestige of the Garibaldian armies, which stood to them in the place of cavalry, artillery, and big battalions. In order, therefore, to protect Barcelona, Medici moved his headquarters to Meri, and there awaited the enemy's attack, drawn up behind the broad Fiumara, or torrent bed of white stones, that passes in front of the village on its way from the neighboring mountain gorge to the sea. On July 15th, Bosco and his 3,000 approached by the high road from Messina to within a short distance of the Fiumara, where Medici's men lay eagerly awaiting them. The royalists, however, wheeled off sharply to the right and marched across the plain to Milazzo. It is possible that Bosco declined battle on account of his instructions from Clary not to initiate hostilities. On his arrival in the town, beneath the precipice on which the medieval fortress is perched, the inhabitants fled for refuge into the thick olive groves that cover the hills of the peninsula beyond, where they remained hidden during the events of the following week. Bosco and his army occupied the deserted town and put themselves into communication with the garrison on the castled rock overhead. Medici, encouraged by Bosco's refusal of battle, sent out detachments across the Fiumara of Meri to occupy Coriolo and Archie hamlets sheltered among the olives of the last foothills that overlook the plain of Milazzo. Now one part of Bosco's instructions had been to occupy Archie, and therefore, in spite of that other part of his orders which forbade him to be the first to attack, he felt justified in recapturing Archie now that a Garibaldian outpost had occupied it and thereby cut off his connection with Messina. He had passed through the village on the 15th on his way to Milazzo, but had neglected to leave any guard behind, and so, early in the morning of July 17th, he sent back across the plain four companies with cavalry and artillery, under Major Maring, with orders to retake Archie. The hamlet and surrounding hills were defended by 300 Lombards under Simonetta and about 70 Sicilians. Maring skirmished for some time, used his cavalry well, captured a score of prisoners, and then unaccountably returned to Milazzo. Bosco placed him under arrest and sent out in the afternoon six companies under Lieutenant Colonel Mara, who assailed Coriolo and brought their artillery into action. Medici sent up two men from Meri, including Malincini's Tuscans, and fierce fighting took place in the streets of Coriolo and along the Fiumara above which it stands. The street was taken by the Bourbon troops and retaken at the point of bayonet. Mara's men tried to turn to Medici's flank by penetrating up into the mountains toward Santa Lucia, but they were headed off near San Filippo. At the end of an arduous day, Coriolo remained in Medici's hands and Archie in those of the royalists. But at midnight, Bosco, who had come out when the fighting was over to review the situation, ordered a retreat to the town. He had been persuaded that Medici had 7,000 men, whereas in reality he had scarcely more than 2,000 all told. Although Bosco's deserved reputation for courage saved him from wholly losing the confidence of his men, his conduct on this day had been neither spirited nor wise. He should have come earlier to direct the action himself, and he should not have sent out such small detachments if he seriously intended to occupy the slopes of the mountains, and so debar the further advance of the Garibaldini along the north coast. He had allowed Medici to outmaneuver him, to drive him down off the hills, to get between him and Messina, and to lock him into the plain of Milazzo with his back to the sea. The Garibaldini were elated at their success and rejoiced over an intercepted letter of Bosco's to Clary, written in the usual querulous style of Neapolitan dispatches. "Maring basically betrayed me. I have him under lock and key. I can't do more. I'm left to do everything, everything, everything. The officers are so many nullities. But if he were reinforced from Messina, either by sea or by land, he boasted that he would enter Palermo on Medici's horse. Those of his dispatches which reached Messina, being signaled by semaphore, were conceived in the same tone of complaint against his subordinates, and demanded fresh men and fresh officers, although in fact he had in the Cacciatori the best regiments of the army. The feeling of the 15,000 officers and men left idle in Messina was that they ought at once to be led to the rescue of the gallant Bosco, who was far more popular than Clary. But the marshal, who had already quarreled with his subordinates at Messina, as well as with Bosco himself, sent him not the reinforcements which he demanded, but a Captain Fonseca, to make excuses and to explain that there were not enough horses, carts, or ships to carry an army by sea or by land to Milazzo. Clary's inactivity was in part due to the telegrams which he received from the Minister of War, ordering him to remain on the defensive, and denouncing Bosco in the strongest language for having resumed hostilities. But although Medici had drawn a cordon around Milazzo, it was a very thin line, and if Bosco discovered that he was being contained not by 7,000 but by 2,000 men, he might attack once more. In the telegram reporting to the dictator his success of July 17th, Medici begged for reinforcements. Nor had he long to wait. Some troops were already on the way. On the 18th, there marched to Meri Dun's regiment of 600 Sicilians with its English officers, and Cosenz with the first detachment of the excellent troops whom he had just brought to Palermo from Genoa. The dictator, on receiving Medici's telegram in the small hours of the morning of the 18th, made one of those sudden resolves, quick as the flash of a sword, that with him always marked the end of a long period of suspense. Breaking through all his engagements in Palermo, and not even announcing his departure, he went on board an old Scottish cattle steamer called the City of Aberdeen that had brought volunteers from Genoa a few days before and happened to still be at the harbour. At 4 in the morning he made arrangements for her use with her Scottish crew and captain, who were passionately devoted to his cause and person. He instantly put on board the carabineers of the 1,000 and those of his aides-de-camp which he could muster at a moment's notice. Just as they were about to weigh anchor, there happened to enter the port the steamer Amazon from Genoa, bearing Corte and his volunteers, captured a month before in the Charles and Jane, and now released from their captivity at Gaeta by the constitutional ministers of King Francis as part of the policy of friendship with Piedmont. They'd been sent back to Genoa, but had instantly sailed again for Sicily in another ship. On account of this adventure, they were henceforth known as the Gaeta Battalion. Garibaldi ordered them not to land, but to come on board the City of Aberdeen. The transfer of men, arms, and ammunition was effected in half an hour, and about 8 in the morning, the cattle steamer left Palermo with the whole expedition on board. She was accompanied by the Piedmontese war vessel Carlo Alberto, under orders from Persano to see them safely landed. They disembarked at Petit before dawn on July 19th. Leaving his men to march after him, the general drove at a gallop towards Barcelona and Meri. At Barcelona, the principal church was employed as a hospital for Medici's wounded. As Garibaldi passed through the town, the noise of his reception in the street penetrated into the quiet of that gloomy hall, where a gigantic crucifix looked down upon the sufferers. In an instant they were struggling off their couches and crawling to the door on hands and knees. As they lay crowded on the steps of the church, he waved his gentle salutations and thanks to them, and passed on towards Mary. One young Lombard, who had been shot in the lungs, crawled to his bed again, fell back on it, and died. When Palermo discovered that the dictator had gone, the streets were filled with angry and inquiring crowds. His departure was a complete surprise. The Palermitans felt only half safe in his absence, and many of his old followers and friends were aggrieved because he had left them behind in the hurry of his departure. Such was the eagerness to follow him that in a few hours nearly all the North Italians in the Sicilian capital had thrown up the civil or military posts which kept them from the front. In many of these cases, substitutes were found among the wounded, who were unwilling to remain in hospital at such a time. Those who could set out post-haste for Milazzo, and quiet was restored. There was little doing at Meri on July 19th. Medici and Cosenz were away scouting, and their men were eating their dinners in the filthy houses of the village, or beside the white stones of the Fiumara, glowing in the midday heat, when an open carriage was noticed coming along the high road from Barcelona. As it drew near, they saw whom it contained. In an instant, all the camp was in an uproar. The uneaten dinners were left smoking, and the volunteers rushed to seize him as he stepped from the carriage. It was his official birthday, being celebrated at that hour in Palermo, with flags and speeches, but he had come to spend it among friends in the field. Confidence and joy were in his looks, and were reflected in the faces of the soldiers who pressed round him. They now knew that on the morrow they would fight and conquer. He did not linger in Meri, but took horse to find his old companions in arms, Medici and Cosenz, and to spend the rest of the day riding with them over the mountains of Santa Lucia, surveying through his spyglass the plain below, where Bosco was in the act of taking up a new and formidable position to cover the approaches to Milazzo. The plain of Milazzo is enclosed to the north and west by the two sea beaches that converge on the town and castle at the neck of the peninsula. To the south and east the plain is bounded by the white Fiumara of Meri and of Coriolo and by the low hills covered with olives that lie between the mountains and the plains. The ground on which the battle was fought, confined within a radius of a mile and a half from the southern gate of the town, was perfectly flat and almost on level with the neighboring beach. On this seaward plain stood farms, mills, and small hamlets, scattered about in a manner foreign to the interior of the island, where the whole population was housed at nightfall in hill towns of several thousand inhabitants each. These isolated houses strengthened the royalist position on the plain. The ground was occupied by cornfields and vineyards, or near the sea by brakes of cranes, 7 feet high, used by the peasants for training their vines. The vineyards and cane brakes were enclosed by thick hedges of cactus, or by high white walls, which had been loopholed by the Bourbon troops. These were formidable barriers against an army of irregulars without artillery. The only way by which Garibaldi's men could pierce the enemy's lines without scaling the loopholed walls and hewing through the cactus edges was to charge along the two beaches and along the various roads converging on Milazzo. But the roads and the beach on either side of the town were remarkably straight and were swept by the cannon of the royalists. Against their 8 excellently preserved pieces, the Garibaldini had nothing to oppose except 2 useless carronades, dragged about by hand, which were brought into action only to be withdrawn after a few minutes. The one road that was not straight enough to be swept by the Bourbon artillery was a sunk lane that wound through the vineyards, hollowed out by a watercourse that finally entered the side of the San Pellino road as a culvert, and issued into the sea under the main road, beneath a little bridge 500 yards from the town gate. This bridge was chosen by Bosco to be the scene of the final stand outside the town, in case his more advanced positions were forced, and here 2 of the cannon were placed. 2 more stood a mile from the front, near the angle of the high road to Messina. Beyond this angle, the Bourbon left wing occupied the mills near the seashore, thus forming an advance post which could enfilade Garibaldi's advance against their center near San Pellino. Their right was supported by the other 4 guns, which were placed at Casazza on the western beach. These formidable positions in front of the castle were held, according to Bosco's own report, by 2,500 excellent Neapolitan cacciatori, the flower of the army, aided by the 8 guns and a squadron of cavalry. In the castle on the rock overhead was the garrison, about 1,000 infantry of the line and over 40 cannon of different sorts, some of which were able to fire with effect towards the close of the day. In the peninsula behind the castle, Bosco had stationed another 400 cacciatori to prevent a landing from taking place in his rear. The total of all arms defending these positions was reckoned by the Neapolitan staff at 4,636 men and officers. Against this series of concentric lines of defense, culminating in the precipice and castle, Garibaldi was leading a force perhaps slightly larger in numbers than that of Bosco, but altogether inferior if judged by the normal military standards. He had no cavalry and until late in the day no artillery. The infantry consisted of North Italian and Sicilian volunteers, hastily raised and regimented in so-called battalions of 300 to 900 each, many of which, like Corte's new-landed Gaeta battalion, had handled firearms only during the last 48 hours and did not know the elements of drill. While even Medici's and Dunne's men, who had had a few weeks' drill, did not know how to use the sights of their Enfield rifles. But in most of the battalions, there was a large proportion of veterans of 48 and 59, of sergeants who had deserted, collusively or otherwise, from the regular army, and of officers of old experiences, and in some cases of remarkable talent in revolutionary war. Above all, the whole force was inspired by the ardor for their cause and for their leader, which did much to take the place of discipline and made them ready to endure the very heavy losses without which even the first positions could not possibly have been stormed. Shortly after the dawn on July 20th, the Garibaldini moved down to attack off the hills of the Olivarella and Coriolo. In the center, San Pietro was occupied without opposition. On the east, Simonetta and his Lombards began their attack on the enemy's advanced posts at the mills, while on the other flank, Malincini and his Tuscans, marching through San Marco and San Marina, developed the attack on Cazzazza and along the western beach. The day began with a disaster. Malincini carelessly led his men up to the mouth of the Bourbon rifles and batteries, which opened on them with terrible effect and fairly drove them off the field. Garibaldi, who was watching the first stages of the fight from the roof of a wine store on the edge of the plain, sent Cosenz with fresh troops to rally the fugitives and to take over the command of the left wing. Nevertheless, the Royalists, supported by cavalry and artillery operating on the broad beach, advanced and drove back the Garibaldian left and left center for nearly a mile. Although Malincini and many of his Tuscans returned to the fight, it was all that Cosenz could do to hold the Zirilli farm and the western approaches to San Pietro. The general himself, rightly confiding in the calmness, authority, and military talent of Cosenz, had not gone to rally the defeated left wing, but had bent all his personal energies to effect an advance along the other shore, at the head of the right wing under Medici. If he could penetrate by way of the mills and the angle of the road as far as the bridge, he would be able to threaten the rear of the victorious advance of the Royalists on the west, which was in fact a dangerous move on their part at so early a stage in the battle. Garibaldi's method of sending troops into action on this day was to stand well exposed to the fire at some spot by which the next detachment would have to enter the battle, and to speak, almost in a whisper, some word of encouragement to the young soldiers, of whom many were then hearing the bullets for the first time in their lives. In a small army of volunteers, depending more on individual courage than on discipline, the general's exercise of his strange powers of fascination considerably increased the chances of victory. As one section of Dunne's Sicilians with their English officers and cadets filed by him into action up the right of a crane break, he kept repeating in a low voice, "Avanti! Coraggio, uomini!" when the veteran company of Genoese Carabineers, destined to lose nearly half their number before nightfall, were brought about 10 in the morning to the place where they were to enter the battle, they found the general there before them, standing almost alone in the middle of the road, a conspicuous mark at which the enemy were directing their fire. The first success of the day was the capture of the mills by the northerners of Simonetta's and of Specci's battalions. It caused a severe struggle, for Bosco was there in person, encouraging his men, and he had skillfully placed two guns near the angle, one on the high road, the other in the mill lane. The latter, after doing great execution, was captured through the devotion of a volunteer named Alessandro Pizzoli, who, leaving his comrades in ambush behind a wall flanking the mill lane, himself sprang down a few yards in front of the cannon's mouth in order to draw its fire. He was blown limb from limb, and the next moment his comrades leapt down after him and captured the piece. Thus the Royalists were slowly pushed back on the east flank from one vineyard and farm to another. But the few positions gained by the red shirts seemed to many but little compensation for the long train of wounded continually passing to the rear, for the suffocating heat, the thirst, the hunger, and as the day wore on, the sheer fatigue. Those who had no stomach for 8 hours of such work went off with the wounded and forgot to return. The better sort of men, getting together in groups, often irrespective of their proper battalions, followed any officer with a turn for leadership whom the chance of battle brought their way. Scarcely ever seeing the enemy through the canebrakes and behind the loopholed walls, but always exposed to his shots, firing only at close quarters, making headway by rushes and rallies, by dashes down the sunk lane, here leaping over a wall and there tearing through a cactus hedge into the flank or rear of the enemy, they carried on the battle, which had now become a mere test of individual prowess. And more and more as the day went on, the general himself appeared, now here, now there, heading charges which behind him never failed of success. One of our countrymen, a lad of 17 who had left his home a few weeks before for love of Garibaldi, found himself with a few of his comrades from Dunes and a number of men from other battalions, standing at the end of a canebrake through which the Royalists were firing at them from behind a wall. The bullets were crashing through the tall canes, which snapped under the shower. The men were falling fast. The position was untenable. Suddenly, the Englishman was aware of Garibaldi's galloping up to them, leaping off his horse, and without a word or look, dashing up the narrow ride between the canes, straight at a small opening in the wall lined by the enemy's rifles. He did not once look round to see if his men were following, for he knew that none who saw him would linger. The Bourbon stood to it to the last, and the bayonet was used before the wall was cleared. By a series of such charges, Bosco's cacciatori were pushed back, well after midday, to their last position outside the town. There was a bridge over the culvert where stood the two reserve guns commanding the straight roads that converged on that spot. Close by, on the shore, was a large factory for pickling tuna fish. Here the crisis of the battle took place. The general sent Missouri to fetch up a detachment of Dunes Sicilians, which had not yet lost its identity in the melee. With these and some North Italians, under Pilati Bronzetti, he passed through a garden, climbed a wall, and dropped down upon the two guns. One was captured, the other limbered up and escaped to Milazzo. Bosco ordered a handful of cavalry, who were standing near the town gate, to rescue the lost piece. A score of them made a spirited charge over the bridge, and Dunes men scrambled out of the road to let them pass. If Bosco had followed up the charge with a body of fresh infantry, he might have won the battle. But his last reserves on this side of the castle had been used by Colonel Mara to support the advance of his right center. As the cavalry rode back from running the gauntlet through the Garibaldian lines, Dunes Sicilians emptied half a dozen saddles, firing from behind the cactus hedge that lined the road. But two men, who had not taken refuge behind the hedge when the cavalry first charged by, were still standing alone in the roadway, on the line of their retreat. Of these two, one was Garibaldi, the other was his aide-de-camp, Missouri, a handsome young Lombard of noted gallantry. Both were on foot, and the horsemen, unable to avenge their fallen comrades on anyone else, swarmed round, eager to cut them down. Missouri shot the horse of the Bourbon captain, who rose in the stirrups as it fell and slashed at the dictator. Garibaldi parried the blow, and laying his hand on the bridle of the kneeling animal, struck the captain in the neck with his saber and killed him on the spot. Missouri, with his revolver, shot two more of the cavalry, and the half-dozen who were still left alive galloped back through the gates of the town. The Garibaldini, now having occupied the bridge, had turned Bosco's left flank and were threatening his rear. The rash advance of his right wing would have to be turned into a hasty retreat if the red shirts could maintain their newly won position. That was indeed no easy task, for the cannon of the fortress, firing over the roofs of the town, played full upon the bridge, while the cacciatori below fired on it at close quarters from the town gate and from the houses along the side of the port. Garibaldi's men fell fast. One of his best and most popular lieutenants, Migliavacca, was killed, and Corte was wounded. An attempt to bring the two carronades, the only artillery of the force, into action on the bridge proved that they were perfectly useless, and in a few minutes the general ordered them to be withdrawn. Seeing that an immediate advance on the town was impossible, he put most of the men for rest and shelter into the tunny factory and some wood stores nearby, while others kept up a fire against the walls of Milazzo from the bridge and neighboring gardens, and from behind the fishing boats on the beach. In particular, paired Garibaldi's Englishman, whose long beard and fine head reminded his comrades of King Lear, kept his company of 30 men at the bridge, suffering severe losses, and demonstrating that Colt's five-chambered revolving rifle, with which they were armed, leaked fire at the breech, woefully scorching the hand that used it, and had therefore no future in the history of modern armaments. During 2 hours in the early afternoon, the affair continued in this state, the Garibaldini losing men, but holding the position they had taken, and resting after the fatigues of the morning's attack. Having thus established his men on the bridge, Garibaldi left them under Medici's command and rode off to deal with Bosco's victorious right wing, which was still pressing Cosenz near the Zirilli farm and San Pietro. For this purpose he made his way down with a few staff officers to the western beach, found a small boat, and rowed out to the Turquerie, a paddle steamer of 400 horsepower carrying 10 guns, which had arrived on the scene that very afternoon from Patti. This vessel, formerly the Veloce of the Bourbon service, had recently deserted him at Palermo, and now composed his whole fighting navy, over and above his transports and such help in convoy work as was afforded him by the Piedmontese warships. His aide-de-camp, watching from the shore, soon saw him swarm up the mast of the Turquerie to view the field. Taking her close inshore, under fire from the guns of the castle, he proceeded to bombard the enemy's cavalry on the western beach. The victorious right wing of the Royalists, feeling the fire of the Turquerie from the west, and learning that their rear had been turned on the east, at length hastened to retreat. This incident calls to mind the obvious truth that if the Neapolitans had sent a part of the fleet to protect Milazzo, their fire would have rendered it impossible for Garibaldi to occupy or even to attack the town. Cosenz and his men, thus relieved by the retreat of their assailants, followed up and, joining with Medici on the bridge, stretched a line across the neck of the peninsula and invested the walls of Milazzo. Next after Garibaldi, Cosenz had borne the burden of the day. He came of a French Neapolitan family, whose military and patriotic traditions dated from the days of the Parthenopean Republic of Marengo and of Marat. But his friends said that Enrico Cosenz seemed rather to belong to some northern race, for his manners were imperturbable in their calm. He was modest and retiring to almost a fault. He had been well called Garibaldi's good angel in politics and war. This thin, quiet man in spectacles had restored the courage of Malaccini's routed troops and held them to their post all day. Now in the late afternoon he was standing close under the walls of Milazzo, in the hottest fire from the fortress, wiping his spectacles with the deliberation of Mr. Pickwick, while a breathless aide-de-camp from Garibaldi, waiting for his reply to a message, wished that he would either make up his mind more quickly or continue his meditations in a more secluded spot. Bosco still might have held out in the town with some likelihood of success. By his own account, he had lost not more than 150 men, a fifth part of the loss confessed by the victors. But his troops were overcome with exhaustion and discouragement at the end of their brave but unsuccessful fight of 8 hours, under an almost tropical sun, and the fear of Garibaldi, which Bosco alone of the Bourbon officers had for a while conjured away, returned upon them like a fate. He therefore marched his cacciatori up to the castle to join the garrison there, leaving only a few soldiers to keep up a fire from the town walls. When about 4 o'clock the Garibaldini began to make their way up into Milazzo, creeping in first along the port side where the walls no longer existed, they found to their surprise that the streets were empty. Even when they advanced to the upper part of the town, no enemy was there, although marksmen in the fortress overhead opened fire upon them and wounded Cosenz. Before sunset the whole city was occupied, and the entrances of the streets were barricaded against the castle. Garibaldi chose for his headquarters the steps of a small church beside the sea. There he sat, giving his orders, propped up against his South American saddle, which he always took off his horse with his own hands. For a few hours at midnight he slept, as he liked best to sleep, with his head upon that soldier's pillow which had served him when youth and love were still his, in lands where man needed only sword and saddle for the free rover's life upon the uplands. End of chapter 4.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.